This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are more than 5 billion websites to navigate, 200 television channels, AM, FM, and now satellite radio, plus cell phones, of course, sat phones, Blackberries, instant messages, and email, and the newspaper. The information age may be a blessing. We can do more, learn more, and be in touch more often, but we're also bombarded, interrupted, and overwhelmed from time to time. Amid the blur, it can be hard to see the difference between useful information and junk. So how do we sort it out? At what point does the benefit of instant information become the burden of too much information? Later in the program, reenactment buffs do their best with the complexities, controversies, and technical demands of 20th century wars. But first, rest stops on the information superhighway and life in the fast lane. Have you embraced the information age? Do you enjoy instant access to information, or does it sometimes overwhelm you? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest is David Levy. He's a computer scientist in the Information School at the University of Washington. Earlier this month, he led a conference on information silence and sanctuary, and he joins us now from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Neil. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you rely, as we just identified you, on technology for your work, but you unplug, as I understand it, at least one day a week.
That's true. I am a practicing Jew, and what that means is that I have a Sabbath practice, which means that one day out of seven, like Christians and Muslims to some extent, I take a day off and I'm unplugged.
I'm not all that familiar with Torah. I don't think it says anything about visiting websites on the Sabbath.
You know, the rabbis seem to have missed that, but they were smart enough to actually realize that whatever the nature of our work is, that we need time off for reflection and for just enjoying ourselves.
But when did a self-confessed email junkie like you decided you actually did need a day off?
Well, you know, it's something that I have been reflecting on for 20 years at least. When I did my PhD at Stanford in the 70s, I was already aware at that time that computers were becoming a really big part of our culture and my life. And when I finished my PhD in computer science and artificial intelligence, I decided to do something completely different. And I went off to London to study calligraphy and bookbinding for a couple of years. And that turned out to be a really brilliant thing to do, fast forwarding to where we are today, because I began to look at and began to reflect on some of the values that we're living, and I was already in my own way trying to find balance.
I understand another thing you studied during your time in London was the arts and crafts movement, which in the 19th century was a sort of reaction to the industrialization of that time.
Well, I wouldn't so much say that I studied it as that I was living in the aftermath of it. The revival of the calligraphy movement around the beginning of the 20th century was part of the arts and crafts movement, which was a movement that was saying, in effect, at a time when so much is beginning to speed up and where things are becoming so mechanized, let's take some things back into our own bodies and our own hands. And so it was only because of that movement 100 years ago that many of the crafts that many people today practice, I mean, the very phrase arts and crafts, which children are introduced to in schools and in camps, that phrase comes from that radical movement 100 years ago.
Is it time for another one, do you think?
I'm suspecting that it may be time, and I think you can see in the stories that people are telling one another, in the articles that are being written, and even in the amount of press coverage that we have gotten about this conference on information silence and sanctuary, mm-hmm. I'm beginning to think that it's perhaps the beginning of a kind of information environmental movement where we begin to talk not just about balancing our natural environment, but balancing our sense of inner well-being and our relationship to information.
Now, this conference, the title might sound as if it's sponsored by crystal salesmen. In fact, it's the National Science Foundation.
Not only the National Science Foundation, but the MacArthur Foundation. And I think you're exactly right that two of the most substantial mainline foundations in this country are beginning to see that these issues require fuller and more public discussion.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, you take your one day a week unplug. What happens when Sabbath is over?
Well, that's the little joke, I'm afraid, with my wife, which is that as soon as the Sabbath is over, I go running upstairs to check my email again, because being off for 24, 25 hours feels like a very long time.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, if you're using such a thing, is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Eric, who joins us from St. Louis.
Well, hello. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling.
I just wanted to say that I was a graduate student at MIT and became very interested in living with a lot less technology. And as almost as part of my graduate studies, I took a couple years off and took my wife to live with an Old Order Mennonite community. And it was a very eye-opening experience, contrary to what you might think. This particular group, anyway, was abounding in leisure time, and I'd say had more of the benefits that most of us try to achieve with a lot of technology by actually abstaining from a lot of technology. And after that experience, we tried to adapt their way of life to a modern city. We now live in St. Louis, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And were you able to?
Oh, very much so. It really helps that where we live now in St. Louis is an older section that was built at a time when people didn't have a lot of modern technology. So the distances are very close. You can walk to the grocery store, the bank, the park, hardware store, and so forth. And the house that we bought for very little money, actually, has 10-foot ceilings and transoms above the doors. So there's a lot of airflow. You can live without air conditioning. So it's actually a mecca, I would say, because you can live very cheaply and live without a lot of technology.
Well, Eric, thanks very much. And I hope it's a cool summer in St. Louis. You don't have to test that airflow too much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. David Levy, his call, though, does suggest the questions about, the contradiction of technology that's supposed to make us all much more efficient and give us more spare time. Of course, we just spend all that spare time getting more technology.
Well, I guess I would make two comments on Eric's really fascinating remarks. The first is that, indeed, the real issue seems to be more of us actually giving expression to the range of possibilities and exploring what possibilities exist for us. Not everybody is going to choose exactly the route that Eric is trying to move in. And I think we may hear from other people during this next half hour who have very different views. So the larger question is, what do we want to choose and what will make it possible to do that? And so I just think it's wonderful that he has chosen that. But I don't think in the end there's necessarily a contradiction between the use of these new technologies and the possibility of greater sense of sanctuary, silence, and well-being. I think we're at such an early stage in their development that we haven't figured it out. And it's exactly because of the kinds of discourse that we're likely to have now that we will begin to figure it out.
Let's get another caller on the line. And Lynn's with us from Kansas City.
Hi. I'm really fascinated by this subject because I left a career in computer science to become an artist. I found I wanted to use my hands as well as my head. And as a matter of fact, my art is calligraphy-based, so I have something in common, I guess, with David, because I find calligraphy to be kind of the antithesis of most of our use of text. And that doesn't mean that I'm not also a computer junkie. I have my iBook and my Palm Pilot and my cell phone, which I'm talking from, and I like living in both worlds.
So you managed to keep a one hand on the keyboard and another on the easel? Is that what you're telling us?
That's it. I go back and forth, and I actually find they enrich each other.
David Levy, that sounds like a balanced approach.
I think it sounds absolutely wonderful, and it seems to work for, is it Lynn who was just speaking?
Yes.
One thing she raises, though, that I think that really came up in our conference was the whole place of the body. And how do we bring the body back into the picture and back into the equation? Just like for Lynn, it's true for me that I went to study calligraphy partly because I wanted to use my hands and my body. But we know very well that our BlackBerries and our cell phones and all of that are physical devices too. And what can we learn from the longing to be more embodied that can help us design these technologies and their uses better?
What can we learn?
Well, that's interesting.
Oh, go ahead.
When I was in computers, I was doing human factors. But that was 25 years ago, and I felt like I was before my time because I wanted screens to do the same thing every time. I wanted keys to do the same thing every time so that when you move from application to application, you didn't have to relearn the keyboard. I wanted the keyboard to be more dependable and, in a sense, an extension of your body. So I think human factors people will have a lot of input into making that so. And I also think that there are hobbies that are coming back that are showing that people want to use their hands, like knitting and quilting and so forth.
And, exactly right.
Yeah, in my art, I use all those things. I have some old computer parts, old computer chips. I use those in my art. I use a lot of geometry and mathematics in my art, and I try to use the fullness of the world.
Well, Lynn, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, you're welcome.
And good luck to you.
Hearing this topic.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It strikes me, David Levy, that at the same time you talk about the arts and crafts movement a century ago, a reaction to the Industrial Revolution, there's always been reactions to a lot of technological innovations. What makes the information age different?
Well, in one sense, you're absolutely right. Nothing. We are always, I think, in some sense, exploring the new, getting very excited about new possibilities, and then wondering at the same time if we're losing something important and valuable about the old. So there is a kind of cultural dialogue that inevitably happens with cultural change. What perhaps is different about what we're going through now is that we're going through it seemingly increasingly on a global level. And so the values that we are beginning to debate and discuss may turn out to be in decades and centuries ahead, global values. And that just suggests that we be very careful about what it is that we are selecting.
Let's get another caller in. Chris joins us from Savannah, Georgia.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in my mid-20s, so I pretty much came of age with the whole digital revolution. And I have to say that one of the most positive things about the whole digital media blitz and email and everything like that has been that it's really hammered home an issue that I've always known academically, but that is to not trust everything that you read. And really has forced me to develop a sort of internal BS filter, if you will, and be really cognizant of issues like media ownership and sources and all that in all realms of media, not just the electronic, but also in traditional as well.
Mm-hmm. David Levy, that's among the subjects you also address.
Absolutely right. I mean, the whole question, we're seeing right now on the web this explosion of amazing information. And the filters, the social and cultural filters really aren't there yet that can help us in a straightforward way discern what's true, what's false, what's trash. So what we actually require is the kind of intelligence that this caller is talking about. But it's not enough to have the intelligence. You also have to have the time. You actually need to put more time into inspecting the sources that you're reading. And time, of course, is one of the things we feel we have the least of, which is then another argument for why, for the sake of our well-being and our productivity and our growing knowledge, that we need more time to reflect.
And Chris, after, I guess, another industrial development, I think somebody came up with the phrase, don't believe everything you read in the newspaper as well. So it's not a new sentiment.
It's going to get longer now.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about when and how to take a break in the increasingly frantic information age. When we come back from our own short break, we'll hear from a media professor who says he thrives on information overload. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about unplugging in the information age. When does instant access to information become too much? Join the conversation. How do you manage the barrage of information in your life? Is new technology a burden or a blessing. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is David Levy, computer scientist, a professor in the Information School at the University of Washington, who organized a conference on information silence and sanctuary. 4 years ago, our next guest published a confession in USA Today. "I surf 4 browser windows at a time," he wrote. "There, I admit it. I use a piece of software called KatieSoft that splits my screen into 4 browsers and allows me to have different sites open at the same time. That's usually a couple of news sites, a search engine, and a site I'm editing. It's all in one window, and I still want more. I'm awaiting the 6 browser version." Well, Srinivasan is professor of new media at the Columbia School of Journalism, and he joins us now on the phone from Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here again.
So did you ever get that 6 version, 6 browser version?
Yes, absolutely. It turns out that the company I was using, KatieSoft, has died a .com death, or at least the version that I was using for a consumer product. But there are now 8, 9 browser windows you can open at the same time.
In that same column, you also said you send out about 100 emails a day, received at least 250. I assume that's all gone up since then.
Yes, this is in the summer of 2000, so now it's 5 times the numbers that I receive, partly from my work doing technology reporting in New York, where I give out my email address on the air on television twice a week. And that's not a good idea if you don't want to hear from people.
I guess not. And your personal website has a calendar where anyone can enter an appointment with you?
Yes, they can. I still get to, look through them and approve them. I like to send back an approved message if I approve the appointment. But the idea was that as a professor, you have to spend a lot of time with your students trying to coordinate when they can come and see you, or office hours they have to come and sign up on your door. This way, I just say, go to my calendar, find a time that works for both of us. And it's actually sort of lazy on my part that forces me to use tools like this, but it's been great. Whenever I want an appointment or anyone wants an appointment with me, I say, just go to my website, pick a time. That way I don't have to keep track of my calendar. They do.
Obviously, their opinion of what's a good time for both of you might be different than yours.
Right, but at least they can see what are the busy times that, that for me at least. And it cuts down on the voicemail phone tag where it says, can you do lunch on Thursday? How about dinner Friday? Monday, you keep...
Mm-hmm.
But by the way, my married friends think this is a terrible idea because it might say they're lunch with Jane. Why are you having lunch with Jane?
Jane,
questions,
yes, exactly,
might come up.
So why is it so important for you to be plugged in like this?
Well, I think that it's important because you want to be able to respond to people who have queries about various things. And the way the Internet works and the way that people have started using it, they presume that if they send out a query to you or they ask you a question, if you don't respond in a certain time, then there's a problem. Also, the faster you respond to messages, the faster you avoid having the kind of pileup that often happens. After a 3-day weekend, you go back to the computer and then you have 200-300 messages, perhaps. So if you do a little bit at a time, you can save yourself time in the long run.
Hmm. Is there any such thing as information overload for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I got to tell you, I now have 12-month-old twins, and so, the information overload of all kinds of things, sensory overload is something that I'm dealing with. But even with them, I found that it's really hard to keep up with everything. And also, more and more people now are online, obviously, and the demands on your e-time are greater. But one of the things I've also discovered with having kids and what I thought would be less time to do things is that you become more efficient with your email and your computer time. You give yourself, an hour between feedings in the middle of the night or something like that, and you become much more efficient because you're faster at processing the things you need to do, and then you don't do everything that you perhaps needed to, but you're at least faster and more efficient.
With 12-month-old twins, you're also not getting any sleep, so you're up all night answering your email.
Well, sometimes. So my friends can tell when the babies haven't been sleeping because they'll say, I saw email from you at 3:30 or 5 a.m. or whatever.
So what does your daily media budget look like?
Well, I spend time throughout the day online. See, I'm able to do part of this because my work is on the computer, so I'm on online. I'm checking and composing things, almost everything I do on the Internet. And also, I've come to the conclusion that if there's something that if someone writes to me with a query or says they need help with something, I write it and then I just post it online, taking out the person's name who sent it to me, so that the next time someone asks me a question, I can just point them to that answer. So that's one of the things I do. Also, I spend time scanning as many websites as I can for news and other information, but also friends and others who send you articles and things that helps you keep track. But you really get the feeling that you're treading water often, that you're behind the times. And so you need as many people to be part of that media budget. It just can't be you trying to understand and surf because there's just too much going on.
Yeah, and you have to show, I think you also said in the article, some discipline. I mean, set a limit. I'm only going to go to 3 websites tonight.
Yes, and I think that's a great way to do it, where you tell yourself, these are the 3 or 4 sites that I need to hit. After that, you just say, well, I just can't deal with it, and someone else will send you the article. And by the way, I wrote that article before the explosion of web blogs or blogs, and so things are even more confused and confusing than they were.
Mm-hmm. David Levy, I wanted to bring you in with Sri, and obviously he's disciplined, sort of, but his idea of not being overloaded and maybe your ideas is maybe a little different.
Exactly. And in fact, but I say more power to him. It sounds like he really is thriving in this environment, that he's making choices that really work for him. But I can assure you that I wouldn't survive very long. And I wouldn't actually be able to do the work that's most important to me if I didn't have quiet, unplugged time. One of the things I discovered, I'm a relatively new professor teaching at the University of Washington in the Information School. And this is only my third full year as a professor because I worked in a think tank for many years. And the rate and at which teaching is proceeding and the amount of information and the committees that one has to be on, which I'm sure Sri knows all about, I have initially found quite overwhelming. And so this idea that once the academy was an ivory tower is certainly no longer the case. But it seems to me that without the ability, for, at least speaking personally, to take time away to really quiet down and to think and read deeply, which has become a luxury to so many of us. Without that, I would have nothing to offer my students.
Do you need that time for reflection, Sri?
I wish I had it. I think, I'm going to look up the professor, send him an email if he responds to me. Maybe we can kind of continue the conversation and get some tips on how exactly to do that. But I think what has happened, at least with my students who are journalists and my TV viewers from WABC TV in New York, they don't give you they assume that you're online all the time and that they want information, they want answers. And so what you have to do is use the technology. As I said, in some cases I have canned answers that if someone writes to me looking for something, I can send them to a place where the answers are already there. So I would love to have the time to reflect and relax, but at this point I don't think it's possible.
Sri, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Srinath Srinivasan is a professor of new media in the Columbia School of Journalism and a columnist for the journalism website pointer.org, and he joined us on the phone from Baltimore, Maryland. You can make an appointment on his calendar if you want, SREE.net. And let's get another caller on the line. James is with us from San Francisco.
Yes, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Great. I just want to talk about balance and technology. Again, we have a cooking show on TV, on public television now, called The Hippie Gourmet. That's HIPPY, gourmet.com.
Mm-hmm.
And our main interest really is to have people obviously go to the site, but to reestablish the connections with their family and their friends through cooking, through gourmet foods, through sustainable living, and also the volunteer programs that we also promote through our show. So we're really trying to say to people, look, technology is important, and there's a balance there, and to use the web effectively, but then to go out into the world and to affect positive change.
James, you're a radio junkie, aren't you, James?
I'm a talk of the nation junkie.
You called during our Macintosh anniversary program.
Yes, I did.
So you have the radio on while you're working?
All the time.
I guess David Levy, we're thinking about these new digital media, but old-fashioned media certainly absorb a great deal of our time.
Exactly right. I mean, I read the newspaper. I can look at the newspaper online, the New York Times, every evening for the next day, but I still want to sit with my cup of coffee and the paper version of the New York Times. Sure.
And there are portions of the newspaper that can slow you down a little bit. Try the crossword puzzle, for example.
Fortunately, I don't have that problem. My father and my sister are really big crossword puzzle junkies, but I've never gotten into it.
James, how's the show going?
the show's going really well. We just got picked up by KRCB in Rohnert Park as our presenting station, and we're looking forward to expanding to PBS National over the summer.
Good luck.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The burden of the barrage of information on the web isn't one we have to bear alone. Technology can be designed to handle some of the task. John Seely Brown is former director of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, the birthplace of the graphical interface on computers, laser printing, and Ethernet. He's also the co-author of The Social Life of Information, and he joins us now. Nice to be with you on Talk of the Nation.
How do you do?
Very well. How can technology help us with information overload?
Well, I think the best way it can help us is to get out of our way most of the time. And for example, you know, consider the automobile. The modern-day automobile uses probably more computing power than your desktop. And yet the normal driver is completely unaware that that computer or the computing systems behind the driving, the driver, are constantly kind of watching over what that driver is doing. And they kind of seamlessly come from the periphery into the center as soon as you get into trouble, for example, panic stopping, mm-hmm. and help you kind of ease into and out of that situation and then fade back again. Notice that the question you never have when you go into a dealer to buy a car is, what operating system does this run? Does it run Mac? Does it run Windows? And so on. You're even unaware that there is a computing system there, but it helps you a tremendous amount when you are in trouble.
Are there other kinds of examples?
Well, I think there are lots of examples. I think that one of the comments that the Tree was making a moment ago is the sense that you often want to pull information from multiple sources on the web. Any one search engine is biased in terms of what does it find and what does it not find. He said he has 6 browsers. There's software out there now that actually goes out and will do 6 different types of searches for you, but then combine them into a graphical rendering. So you can look at the clustering and the categorization of these things that have come back, so you get kind of a graphical sense of what is going on. And I feel that kind of the big issue we have now is how do you start designing systems that you have not only just the center of information, but the periphery, the visual forms that help orient you as to what's really there.
So better design the systems so we use them more efficiently?
Well, not only use them more efficiently, but we see like the background and the foreground. You notice that if the way we operate in the real world is we have a very active peripheral vision. And it's the peripheral vision that kind of keeps us oriented and keeps us from being surprised. For example, you know, if you really want to experience the information overload, consider the following experiment. Suppose you take 2 empty toilet tubes, glue them onto your eyes, your eyeglasses, and walk around the world. What happens within 30 minutes? Most of us will collapse into a twitching heap. Why? Because basically we're cut off, our peripheral vision isn't working any longer, and that's what starts to alert our mind subconsciously to prepare to interpret something that's about to fly into our center of vision. Now, in the computer system, it's like looking always through the world through these toilet tubes. We have no periphery. We have no kind of awareness of where we're going to jump next or what's going to come at us. And so as a result, basically, we're using a very small percentage of the human mind, of the human brain, to be able to kind of process this information. So therefore, we always feel in a state of anxiety.
We're speaking about information overload with David Levy and John Seely Brown. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. David Levy, I wanted to get your reaction to John Brown's suggestion.
I think John is making a lot of sense. He made some of these remarks at the conference 2 weeks ago about center and periphery and about tunnel vision. Another speaker at the conference who later echoed exactly what John was saying is somebody from Microsoft, a guy named Bill Hill, who's a developer there and who's also, what he does is he tracks animals in the wild. And what he's discovered through his tracking activities is how much of his whole body and all of his senses it's necessary to use in order to get around in the woods. So you know what's behind you. You can tell what kind of animal tracks you have and what other animals may have been met. And so what Bill is coming to realize, as John is saying, is that we're using at the moment very limited sensory channels. We've got this little focal plane essentially right in front of our eyes, but going back to what one of the callers was saying earlier, we're not using enough of our body and our senses yet.
Let's get a caller back in the conversation. Dan is with us from Des Moines, Iowa.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was just astounded that this person was talking about 6 browser windows. I've been doing 50 browser windows plus on the CIOweather.net, and we do radar and stuff all over the country, and I'm using 4 browsers on my PowerBook concurrently on a fairly regular basis to do all these different tasks and do all them in parallel and very rapidly. And just and then when you're talking about this sensory...
Well, before we get to the sensory part, I mean, you're using 50 windows at a time. Is it overwhelming?
Not if you structure correctly, no. The trick is to structure everything very logically, and then you can set up these channels, and you can just pipeline everything right straight into your brain. And I call it instant learn, because you can quite literally set up a pipeline and actually, you can read, 4 websites almost, concurrently. Not quite, but close.
You can read 4 websites concurrently. I can't. But anyway, Dan, do you find you have to unplug to refresh yourself and get some idea of the meaning of what you're doing all the time?
Periodically. What I do is I set up, and so I've automated part of it, so it's kind of like a matrix of data flow, and part of it just takes care of itself automatically. And then the other part of it, I just pull back and just let it slide, saying it's not life or death, it's a website.
Well, Dan, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Bye.
We just have a little bit of time left with you two gentlemen, and I wanted to ask you both, how much do we have to depend on technology to keep us from getting overwhelmed by technology, and how much do we have to depend on ourselves to filter out information and maybe show some discipline? John Seely Brown, you first?
Yeah, I think that it's not just technology or the individual, it's society. I mean, after all, we invent new types of genres, and those genres give us this kind of the stability to be able to read information in that genre. The way I read a novel is completely different than I read a comic book. It's completely different than I read a history book. And what's happening now is, as David was saying earlier, we're just at the forefront of beginning to build some kind of stable ways to kind of read the information age or to read the information on the web.
And David, I'm going to give you the last 20 seconds.
I would just say, let's look at libraries. Let's look at libraries as institutions that are bringing together both the physical sanctuary and digital technology. So I think we have institutions in our culture that are actually pointing the way.
Thank you both. Appreciate it. John Seely Brown, former director of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, was on the phone with us from his home in Palo Alto. David Levy, a computer scientist with the University of Washington Information School, was with us from KUOW, our member station in Seattle. You can find out more about the University of Washington's Information and Quality of Life program on npr.org.